Hello, everyone. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors all across the genres. Right now, we've got an interview with Andre Dubuque III, author of Townie, The House of Sand and Fog, and The Garden of Last Days. It's a good one. It's a good one. If you missed his keynote address at the PNWA's 60th Writers Conference this summer, you can check out the interview we had right before then. It's a good one. You can find that at authormagazine.org, and we're funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, who have been supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. You can find out more about the PNWA at pnwa.org. I should tell you that I will be teaching some classes for the PNWA this fall, two different memoir classes, a beginning and an intermediate memoir class. Those are five-week classes. And then I'll be doing a one-day workshop called Marketing for Authors Who Hate to Market. And I think there's a lot of you out there. So if you're interested in either of those classes, go to pnwa.org and sign on up. So writing is all about evolution. Art is all about, life is really about evolution, isn't it? But writing and the arts, it's about change, about evolution. Poetry, for instance, has seen quite a bit of change. Once upon a time, it rhymed, and then it didn't. And then it lost all form altogether, and then it kind of got some form back. And eventually, it turned out, well, part of it grew into what we call spoken word or slam poetry. This was a really interesting evolution in poetry, somewhere between poetry reading and performance art. And today's guest, good Lord, I almost choked on myself. Today's guest, Karen Finney-Frock, has really been around the world of spoken word and slam poetry since its inception. In fact, she was named by Seattle Magazine as Seattle's Queen of the Spoken Word. But Karen has allowed herself to evolve also as an artist, and now she is included in her her repertoire of writing novels. And she's the author most recently of the young adult novel Starbird Murphy and The World Outside. And she is with me today to talk about novels, poetry, slam or otherwise, and just writing in general and life. And Karen, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. I'm really glad to be here.
Well, I'm glad you're here. You'll have to excuse me. I just about choked.
Yeah, I heard that happen. I was a little worried.
Oh, my God. I'm okay, though. I'm alive, good, and I'm here, and I'm talking to you. So, Karen, you know, I had the pleasure to meet you while we were teaching at the at NYLA, at the Northwest Institute of Literary Arts winter program. And yeah, we met at Chuckanut Writers Conference the year before that. But I don't know how things started for you. I know that you were there at the inception of slam poetry, but surely the writing itch began before that even. Or did it? Or did it really start then?
Sure, yeah. Technically, I wasn't really there at the beginning of Poetry Slam. Poetry Slam recently celebrated its 25th anniversary. It started off in Chicago. It was invented by a retired construction worker named Mark Smith. I actually got involved in Poetry Slam. That's a common thing that we say in the slam world, and then the audience yells, "So what?" after we say it. It's a great tradition. I actually got involved in Poetry Slam around the 10th anniversary, so I got involved about 15 years ago. And I started started slamming in Washington, D.C., and in 1999, I was on the Washington, D.C. National Slam team and went to the big National Poetry Slam in Chicago and really just fell in love with it. I mean, I didn't really know poetry could even sound like that. And again, it was 15 years ago, so it just wasn't I feel like now spoken word and slam is pretty well known. You know, like most high school kids could probably tell you a little bit about spoken word or poetry slam. At the time, 15 years ago, that was not the case. I really, even having studied poetry some in college, really had not even really heard that it existed. So it felt really revolutionary at the time. It was thrilling, and it, you know, for a while was really all I wanted to do with my time. And around that time, I had heard. Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
No, keep going. I'll come back to that question.
Okay, great. I was just going to say, around that time, you know, I had always sort of had a fantasy about moving to the West Coast, and I had heard that Seattle was a hotbed for spoken word.
Yeah.
And you know, the stars aligned, and I ended up moving to Seattle and just hit the ground running, and immediately I was going to, you know, 3 or 4 open mics or poetry slams a week, and I'm really just in love with the art form for years.
Yeah, I remember there was a place called I had loved poetry. Poetry writing was really where I learned to really write, and I loved doing readings. And this was I was doing readings in like 88, 89. And so poetry slams had probably hadn't really begun at that point, but I loved doing readings, and because I was a bit of a theatrical fellow. And I remember coming to Seattle, and there was a place called Flowers on the Ave that was a bar that used to be a flower shop. And they did, and I said that they said they're doing something called slams. And I said, what the hell is that? And this was probably 95, 94, something like that. And I thought, oh man, if I were just a little bit younger and still doing poetry, this is what I'd be doing right now, I think.
Yeah, I loved it right away.
But why did you love it? Why? Tell me, because for someone who, explain what it is you love about it beyond just sitting down and quietly writing a poem. All by your lonesome.
You know, I have always loved to hear poems out loud. I've just always been the kind of person who, if I have a free afternoon and a comfortable seat and a sunny window, I'm alone, I'm probably going to read a novel. But if I'm going out to a reading to be around other people, I'm not as interested in hearing a novel read aloud. I'm sorry to you novelists, I do it now too. But I'm sort of less interested in that, and I'm more interested in hearing poems aloud. And to me, the experience of hearing poems read out loud has just always been an incredibly pleasurable and joyous one. And there is, we all know, I think, a particular talent to reading a poem well out loud.
Yes, there
and
is.
Not all people who write wonderful poems read them wonderfully out loud. And
no.
So I just became really interested in, you know, what is that art form? Sort of how do we learn that part of that skill of poetry and really practice and seeing other people who are excellent readers is the best way I have found to do that. And the best place I found to do that was at the Poetry Slam.
Yeah, because the slam is really some kind of hybrid between the poetry reading and essentially somewhere like around hip hop or one person theater almost. It blends a lot of different elements to it. It's not just I'm going to get up and read my poem. Well, there's such a performance aspect to it, getting into character almost.
There is a performance aspect to it, and sometimes I would say that involves getting into character, especially if a person is, say, performing a persona poem. Although
right.
One of the things that I like about poetry performance poems are that you're not necessarily seeing an actor at work. You know, you're usually seeing a different sort of a person, which is the person who likes to write the piece and then the person who likes to hear the musicality of the language spoken aloud, which is a bit different than an actor who is more about character and more about creating a living
That's
character.
True. And it always struck me when I did poetry readings for myself that I always tried to, I kind of wanted to become like transparent is always the word I thought. I wanted to show up, but I also wanted to disappear in a way. And just kind of let it pass through me. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, absolutely it does.
Because I don't want to get in the way of it.
Yeah, those are my favorite types of readings in which the person doing the reading becomes sort of a vehicle for the words themselves to have a musical quality and to sing to the audience.
Music. See, that's the thing, is that writing language, I couldn't sing, Karen. Not really. I really wanted
Neither
to.
Neither can I.
But I said, but I could talk. I mean, I could speak. And writing, I mean, language has beats. It has rhythm. It has highs and lows. And if you let it, it can be song-like, I think.
Yes, I think so too.
you know. And so how did, before we get to Starbird Murphy, how do you feel that you evolved as a writer and a performer over the years? What did you see grow the most within you as you evolved as a mature artist?
I think as I evolved, I found that I had more things that I wanted to say.
Mm-hmm.
When I started, it was more about simply the love of language, the musicality of words, the emotion that could be evoked through them. And then as I continued to write, got older and simply just had more life experiences, I found that there was something that I wanted to find a way to articulate.
And
the goal of the writing then became about that.
You know, I know just what you mean, and I've often felt that way about my own work, which is that I feel like there's one central thing, and that I keep coming at it again and again and again and again and again, and understanding it and understanding it, and I've kind of learned what that is. Was that what you're talking about, that there was kind of a central theme that you kept returning to, or that there was a sort of garden of ideas that you had become interested in as you matured?
I think there's been a number of themes, not just one, but a few. And I think one of those themes has been grief. I think one of those themes has been, how do we continue to be humans when we sort of are constantly balancing on the edge of this precipice? And how do we continue to have meaningful lives and avoid sort of the fear that they could be over at any moment? And sort of instructions for living in a way, which, of course, I'm really intending for myself. I don't have those
of
answers.
Of course. Of course, you're intending them for yourself.
Yeah.
That's the best instruction. And now the precipice, what precipice are you talking about? Are you talking about the precipice of grief or of simply annihilation? Which precipice?
I think annihilation, in which I include not just death, but the losses that feel almost as large as our own deaths, you know, the deaths of those we love. And
sure.
And even in some ways, just the death of safety, comfort. I think about during the tsunami that destroyed so many villages in Thailand. I think that there was a woman who was a survivor who was the only survivor in her entire village.
Yeah.
And so when I talk about the precipice, you know, it's not just our own deaths, but how does a person go past that sort of experience and continue on after something like
it's
that?
It's a biggie. You know, I actually think, Karen, it is, I have come to the conclusion at 50 years of age that there's really only one thing that humans talk about again and again, and that's whether their well-being, their happiness, their sense of peace and safety is conditional or if it's unconditional. I think we talk about it and talk about it and talk about it. Is it conditional or isn't it? And that's what you're talking about. Is your sense of safety based on the conditions and whether there's a wave coming or isn't, whether your loved one has died or hasn't, or is it everlasting? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
It's a big question.
In a terrifying way, right?
Well, it can be, because, perhaps that's a discussion for another time, but I think that it is one that has been responsible for a lot of poems and a lot of books, is what about the fact that I die and that everyone seems to do it by and by. All right, so the poetry evolved like that, but eventually you found yourself with a desire to write a book, a novel. What was behind all that?
Circumstance, really. I had to leave Seattle. I had a sick family member. I went back to the small town where I grew up and lost that family member. And then, for the two or more years of intense grief that followed, I wasn't able to write poetry. Whatever wellspring of internal introspective attention brought the poems about, I couldn't bear to look within.
Yeah.
And so at first, writing the novel was just an escape from reality. and a long, demanding escape from reality, right?
The yeah.
number of hours and the type of attention that it takes to create another world and live within that world was just the type of healing that I needed at the time. And
yeah.
so, and, you know, I was living in, you know, a pretty small town, didn't have a lot of friends. I had my family around, but I had a lot of time on my hands. And that almost sounds dismissive, but truly I do think that writing a novel requires just so much more butt-in-the-seat time than writing poetry does, that I needed
yeah.
that sort of time to learn how to write a novel, to write, you know, a practice novel and put it in the drawer and never pull it out and then start writing another novel and then, you know, rip out half of it when it wasn't working and write it again. And, you know, just the amount of time that it takes to learn to be a novelist is a stunning amount of hours.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's the whole muscle for telling a book-length story of somehow having an understanding of what that story is, even while you're discovering it. It's a totally different thing than the poem, which you can kind of hold, not that you memorize it, but you can have a sense of the whole thing in your mind at one time almost, it
yeah.
seems like. Whereas the novel, there's a whole, like, long-distance sight you need that you have to really learn, I think.
I think so, too. Still
you
learning
know what I mean?
It.
You're still learning it.
I am, yeah.
So you started. So what was the? So aside from the time, I mean, there's so much you have to. You have the characters and plots. You made. Were you an outliner? I bet you weren't. Or were you? No, I bet you weren't.
I have to admit, the way that the novel started was that I opened up my laptop and wrote chapter one.
Yeah, that's, that's what I figured.
Going, you know, yeah, I just started going with a strong voice.
Yeah.
I was telling a first-person narrator protagonist, and it was her voice stuck in my head,
yeah.
and I just started there and did no outlining, virtually no planning, and really paid for it later in the in the process. So now I love outlining and
really.
You
can do that.
I'm a devoted
right.
outliner now.
was Starbird Murphy outlined?
It was. It was painstakingly outlined with, of course, plenty of room for surprises. I absolutely believe in the surprises and the eureka moments that happen in the actual process of putting the words
yeah.
on the page. So I leave a lot of room for that and for changes. But I also do lots of planning now. I feel that it saves me from a lot of the dead ends that I kept walking down. Not from all of them, for sure.
Yeah.
I've walked down many dead ends on the novel I'm working on now, but it saves me from some of them.
Saves you from some of them. And you feel that you can, in the planning, you have some kind of internal guidance system that tells you, because I could never do it because I couldn't tell, like, until I got to the page whether my ideas had any merit at all. You know, I felt like I always had to write them to know if they were going to work. But do you have a feeling within you, even before you write something, that really belongs? Do you have a
yes,
kind of...
Yes, but I don't always trust it, and it's not always right.
Yeah.
So what I do is I get an idea of where I think I might be headed. And I'm actually, I work visually really well. So what I did is I have an office where I write, and I painted one of those walls with chalkboard paint. And
mm-hmm.
I hang up lots and lots of sticky notes and, you know, make lots of arrows and put lots of big ideas up on the wall. And that's incredibly helpful to me to be able to see it all. So I sort of create all of that. But, yeah, I don't have a ton of faith in it. I mean, sometimes there will be one idea that I am convinced is absolutely right and is
yeah.
definitely where the novel is heading. And even then, it might not be true. So,
yeah.
You know, I try not to be too worried about that. I think that is as it should be. And
yeah.
I think it's actually a good sign that I'm not too married to my ideas when I go in.
I think you can't be, because I think the blank page tells you whether that thing belongs. I mean, there's always your ideas. And then, because you know what happens, Karen, is you write along and you can outline, but you can't outline every frickin' word, right? And so one word can land and it might be something your character says, and that can change everything. And if it's true, you got to keep it, right?
Yeah, and the other thing that I think changes it is that sometimes character motivations seem believable in the big picture, but then once
Right.
you get to know those characters more intimately, you might think, oh, they would never make that decision. That just doesn't
Yeah.
ring true now that I really know them. And I think that can change the whole course of the story as well.
Yeah, definitely. Well, listen, we have a guest or a caller who wants to ask you a question.
Really?
Jeffrey, is that you? Yes, we do. Jeffrey, is that you?
It is I, Bill. Another excellent interview as always, my friend.
Thank you.
Fascinating. And also especially sweet to have another fellow poet on. Hello, Karen.
Hello.
My question is, in 2010, you traveled to Nepal as a cultural envoy for the U.S. Department of State to perform and teach poetry. I need to know this. What was that in which what has surely been an amazing experience for a poet? What was that like?
Yeah. Good question, Jeffrey. What was
yeah,
your trip to Nepal like?
Thanks for that. Great question. It was eye-opening. I had never traveled in the developing world before, and it was also wonderful. The thing that surprised me the most is that there is a deep cultural love for poetry in Nepal,
mm-hmm.
and also the way that Nepalese, generally speaking, speak and communicate is incredibly expressive.
Okay.
It's really expressive through eyes and through gestures. And so, you know, not only were we sort of there saying, going into a classroom saying like, oh, who wants to write a poem today? And everyone was cheering. We do. We
really?
Can't wait to write poems. Which, you know, I go into high schools here in Seattle and
yeah.
teach poetry, and I wish I could tell you that the reaction was quite that enthusiastic among some students it is. But so incredible enthusiasm about poetry, deep, deep cultural love for poetry. And then we were saying, okay, so, you know, don't be scared. We're going to get up and share these poems. This is spoken word. And
right.
Really, in a sense, we were wasting our breath because I feel that the students got up and immediately began expressively reciting their poems in ways that I was learning from watching them do. So
wow.
both of those things were really eye-opening and tremendous. And I think the results have been even more surprising and tremendous, which is that spoken word poetry caught fire in Kathmandu. There
mm-hmm.
are now, there's a large group called Word Warriors in Nepal, and they are poets who are not only now regularly performing and giving workshops, but also traveling to smaller villages in Nepal and giving poetry workshops there too. They brought the poet Sarah Kay over about 2 years after we went. And it's really become a magnificent community in Nepal. There is now a giant spoken word community in Nepal.
And
so,
did it start from
been,
that little trip?
It started from that little trip, and
wow.
Sarah Kay was recently in Seattle, and we did a benefit show at the Fremont Abbey to send money to Nepal for the earthquake funding.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was really a wonderful experience. I'm so glad that I got to go.
Do you like teaching?
I do. I love teaching. I especially am passionate about working with teens.
Yeah.
But I teach adults as well. I teach adults to write novels and teens to write poetry and occasionally vice versa.
Now, why are you so particularly passionate about working with teens? What is it about the teen that interests you as a student?
That's a great question. I think it may be related to the same reason that I write novels for teenagers,
mm-hmm.
which is that I had I just felt like a very, as many, many teenagers do, I felt like a very expressive child, and I couldn't quite
uh-huh.
find enough outlets for that expression.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I tried a bunch of different things. I sort of tried playing an instrument, and I tried, being in plays, and I tried a bunch of ways to get out all of these many buried feelings I was having, and
yes.
I just didn't quite find one that fit, and I think, I did finally find that fit with writing, but I didn't find it until later. I didn't find it until after college. So
oh.
I think part of it is the the opportunity to just kind of revisit my teen self and through writing about those years. And then I think part of it is to hopefully get that opportunity to the kids like me who would fall in love with writing at that age if they just had found it.
Describe for me that moment after college when you did find writing. How did that happen?
So I had some sort of disastrous college experiences with writing, a couple of them. I went to college in Virginia, and I took a Poetry 101 class, which I can't say went well. You know, there was a lot of workshopping. There was a lot of that sort of thing that can happen in classrooms where people give one another harsh critique just in order to try and seem wiser than the person next to them. And, you know, nothing about it smacked of the sort of love that I had found just in reading the poems or that I was looking for. You know, it just, I don't know if I really would have gone on in writing poetry after that class. It did not give me what I was looking for. I tried taking a fiction writing class, and I think it was worse. It was full of a lot of people taking it to fulfill some sort of arts credit that there were a lot of like business majors who could not have been less interested. So really just bad experiences. And then it was when I left college, it was actually the first night that I just really stumbled by luck into an open mic poetry reading and was even though it was a small open mic in a tiny bar in a little town, I was just immediately in love with it, everything about it.
Did you get up there and do something?
I did not.
Oh, okay. Good Lord, I thought she's not that brave.
I'm coming back next time, you know, that's kind of...
That's awesome.
I was filled with the fire right away.
Wow. Would you, let me ask, do you think you would ever be able to write that scene so that you could capture what you went through?
Ooh, I never even considered that before. What an interesting thought.
It's an interesting challenge. Could you capture the Karen before and the Karen after?
Yeah, it's such a great challenge because in some ways, as in writing a great character, I feel like in some ways I would have to trail back through many years of myself growing up to even articulate how large of a change that was to happen in one night.
I know, that's what I tend to...
writing prompts.
That's right. That's what I have. You know, when I write, I only write memoir-ish things now. And so I usually I would start with an end like that. And I think, okay, what do they need to know for them to understand what happened to me then? And I kind of back up. I try to go back as short a distance as possible, but sometimes I'm back in my infancy. You know, I try to make it quick, but I can't. Well, listen, Karen, this has been fascinating. I am so glad I got you on the show, but I'm not quite done with you. I will have one more question that I'd like to ask all my guests, and I want to ask it of you. So what I'd like you to do is finish this sentence for me. Are you ready?
Sure.
Okay, you were born ready. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me what?
If writing has taught me anything. Life lived without risk. It's a boring life.
Have you risked much in your writing? Do you feel like you've risked much in your writing?
I feel like it's the big lesson I'm up against right now. I've recently had a realization about my writing, which is that I realize that I have been protecting my protagonists too much.
Uh-huh.
That sort of fear of letting bad things happen to my protagonists is robbing a lot of the excitement from my stories. And I think the same could be said for our lives. The more we seek to protect ourselves and avoid risk, the less reward we can expect in terms of a thrilling life.
I agree. One of my favorite books says, "In my defenselessness, my safety lies." And I totally agree. Well, Karen, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. Good luck. Well, Starbird Murphy, I know, did very well, and I'm looking forward to the next one. Will there be another one? I know there's another one coming.
Well, there will. I'm working on it right now. The working title is "The Year We Ruined the House."
Oh,
another YA title. Thanks.
It's a It's a very nice title, and I'm sure the book that lies underneath it is just as delightful. Karen, good luck with it.
Thank you so much. Pleasure talking to you.
Pleasure talking to you. Oh, everybody, yes, you got to risk. You got to risk, people. You risk to see how safe you really are. That's the truth. You do. Well, listen, next week I will be talking to Christine Meekoff, who's written a book for widows and how they can carry on from there. But in the meantime, go write something risky and learn how much you love life. Because you do. You may not know it, but you do.